This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse, or give us a call. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Joining us, as always, to talk about the news is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Susan Raff. She's political reporter for WFSB Channel 3. Hi there, Susan.
Good morning.
And Russell Blair is here. He's a reporter on Hartford Courant's Metro Desk. Hello there, Russell.
Great to be here.
So we're going to start with a story that we've been following for a number of weeks that had a little bit of a climax yesterday. Let's hear some voices from the state capitol talking about the decision to not move forward the nomination of Governor Malloy's choice to be Supreme Court Chief Justice.
I really, on a personal level, like Justice McDonald. Folks in this chamber know this was not an easy decision for me to make.
So this hearing and this line of questioning to Justice McDonald was different. It was unlike others, and this nominee was treated differently from how other justices had been treated in the past.
I am convinced that this nomination was a mistake, and I think that this chamber does right to reject it.
I encourage my colleagues to please think long and hard about this decision, because I'm afraid we won't be able to ever turn back.
We just heard the voices of four senators, John Kissel, Beth Bayh, Joe Markley, and May Flexer. I think by the voices and the content of their comments, Colin, we can tell what side of this issue they were on. Essentially, a 1916 vote in the state Senate quashed the nomination of Andrew McDonald to be the state's next Supreme Court Chief Justice. We've been following this for some time because there's been a lot of politics back and forth. Now that we have a decision on this, what new do we know?
I don't know if we know anything new, although I would say that we're in a new era as of yesterday or this morning. I was racking my brain this morning to try to think of another Supreme Court, Connecticut Supreme Court appointment, or even a judicial appointment that was turned away on essentially political grounds, which I think we have to concede is what happened here. The closest thing we have is Peter Zarrella, but that's not really the way that played out. And there were some things about that nomination that made it different. And so I think we are kind of on new ground here. And I think May Flexer is right, too. It may be difficult to turn back from where we are right now. I'd like to spend a moment, you know, I think not for the first time on this show. I'd like to quote Casey Stengel during his time with the Mets when he famously said, "Can't nobody play this game?" This is there isn't a real Sun Tzu in the mix here in terms of like how this whole thing worked out. Let's start with Malloy's office. If you're Malloy's office, and I realize he's kind of heading down the home stretch, a lot of his senior staff is gone. Some of the people who might have been able to kind of whip this question into shape aren't there anymore. But if you've got any kind of gubernatorial office, you know that A, it's 18-18 in the Senate. B, it's a Malloy-unfriendly 18-18. In other words, it's a place where he doesn't really have any goodwill that he can cash in. Marty Looney, who's the party leader in the Senate, is probably unlikely to shed his own blood on behalf of Dan Malloy. So you know you have a very difficult environment. You also have a signal, starting with the committee vote, which was 2020, that you've got problems. You also know exactly who your problems are in the Senate. Typically, it's Schlossberg, it's Doyle, and it's Hartley. So you know you have to pay a lot of attention to those three people. What are they going to do? And they don't seem to – I mean, you just don't do this without a nose count. And they should have had a nose count pretty early. They shouldn't have been surprised by Schlossberg's recusal, which was the death knell for the McDonald nomination. But it just – none of this was executed very well. I also would say that support for McDonald when it began to take the form of robocalls and TV ads was probably also a misplay, had a kind of probably a little bit more of a quality of deepening the politicization, backing people into a corner, hardening their positions as opposed to loosening those positions. I think that was a misplay by the people who did that. And I actually also don't think Len Fasano's game theory here. I mean, we can talk as we go along here today about what the real kind of almost policy implications are or implications for good government. But I think his game theory is off too. I mean, he was apparently offered Andrew Rohrabach as an associate justice, Andrew Rohrabach, a former Republican legislator, in order to get McDonald. I think there's a case to be made for taking that deal. What is he going to get now? He's going to get probably Rick Robinson as the nominee, who's an associate justice now, as the nominee for chief justice. He's kind of nominally, I mean, in the past he was a Republican, but he's also very close to Dan Malloy. He was assistant corp counsel in Stanford for years. Malloy will now get, in order to replace that, to fill that slot, he'll get a Democratic nomination, and he'll make sure he's got the 18 votes plus Nancy Wyman this time. He'll absolutely make sure that's, you know, that can go through on a party line vote. So I don't really see what Fasano gets out of this. I think he would have had a better win and less political poison if he'd taken the deal he was offered.
I think you're right. I think this is definitely unprecedented. And we've heard the homophobia mentioned several times. The governor, right after the vote, spoke about that. But I think the overriding factor for a lot of lawmakers, and you touched on that, is they want to stick it to Malloy. I think that he's very unpopular. They didn't want a Democrat in there, and they didn't want Malloy. I see some similarities almost with Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch on a national level when President Obama was leaving. So I think that is it. But what I see most of all in this, and there's been a lot of tension, certainly in this administration, but it's ugly right now. And I think the relationship between Malloy and the senators is damaged severely.
I think it's absolutely about they want to stick it to Malloy. You know, we've talked before about the divisions in the legislature. Republicans have an 18-18 tie in the Senate. The House is very close. I think they see this as, you know, this is something that Governor Malloy really wants. This is a guy that he's a good friend with. This is a guy that worked in his office. He appointed him to the Supreme Court. You know, he would love nothing more than to have him as Chief Justice. And I think, you know, they looked at the political divide and they made this calculation that they could block this. And I think they also made a legal argument. You know, they didn't go out there on the Senate floor and say, we're doing this because we don't like Dan Malloy. So they built a legal argument. But I think it started with the idea that this was something the governor really, really wanted. And they found a way that they could deny him that.
But to get back to Colin's sort of game theory point to this. So we've had Democratic control of the legislature for quite some time, including a couple terms with a Democratic governor. And so now you have a situation, Russell, where there is this tight vote. You have Republicans with more say and more control. There's a lot of things that Republicans actually want to get during their time with some leadership. And the thing that they want to maybe burn some of this political capital on is taking down a nominee because they don't like Governor Malloy. Like, it seems to me like whether it's an Andrew Rohrabach deal or something else they're trying to get, that maybe there's something better that Republicans might get other than saying, nope, not your guy, Dan.
I mean, as much as you can see how this has certainly activated the Democratic base. You know, I was on Facebook yesterday while the vote was going on, and these different grassroots groups that have stepped up are, you know, calling out these Republican senators. They're certainly mad about this. But I think you can make the argument for a lot of these Republicans, if they go back to their districts and they say there was a guy that was really good friends with Dan Malloy. Dan Malloy wanted to make him the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and I voted against that, and here are my reasons X, Y, Z. I think there are a lot of people that would find that argument compelling. But I also think that, you know, who is the Supreme Court Chief Justice is not something that a typical voter in November is going to care about. It's going to be about the economy. It's going to be about, you know, much bigger issues than this. But both sides, I think, are going to try to make this into a campaign issue.
November or perhaps any other month. I mean, this question, Susan, that was raised earlier by May Flexer and Colin said, you know, maybe we won't be able to turn back. Well, is this a function of this moment in which the Republicans have a bit of control and you have this outgoing governor that they can't stand and wanting to have an anti-Dan Malloy thing that we can take to the polls in November? Or does this signal something longstanding about the way this is going to work now at the state capitol, no matter who the governor is, no matter who's in charge of the state legislature?
Well, I think the Republicans have been gaining control, as we've witnessed with the split in the Senate, and they've gained a significant ground in the House. So I think they're flexing their muscle. They know that they have power. Will that go forward? Well, that depends on, you know, who replaces Dan Malloy. But I wanted to add something. I think that the anti-gay thing is a very slippery slope. And I think when you bring that up, it really kind of changes the tone of things. Are there people who are anti-gay? They probably are. But I mean, when Senator Fasano was accused of that and other Republicans, I think that backfired. And I think they were very angry about it.
I would agree with things that both of my fellow panelists just said. First of all, yeah, I think with the LGBTQ part of this, they're also starting to think about being able to raise some money off of this in the LGBTQ.
Yeah, I will say that there was a fundraising email that went out pretty much minutes after the vote from the state Democratic Party. You know, Republicans are playing Washington politics. They blocked this. This is Mitch McConnell. So there's certainly a fundraising aspect to it.
Right. I mean, raising money isn't what it used to be in the era of the Citizens Elections Program. But you still have to raise money, and you can raise money. You can raise money for the party itself. I think they will be able to raise some money off that, and they can probably raise more money on their side than the other side can. But I also think that Russell's correct about the fact that I think both sides think this works as an election issue in certain districts, in districts that they care about. They think it's going to work as an election issue. And they might be right. I mean, you know, they know their districts better than I do. But I think in general, yeah, not very many people are going to change their votes for a representative or a senator based on what happened with Andrew McDonald. And if anything, I think one thing that we know, and the General Assembly seems not to know, is that the public is mortally sick of them, not certain of them, but of them. And one of the things they're sick of is squabbling about purely political issues as opposed to moving forward with the business of the state. I think there's a perception out there that we're in a moment of stasis where not a lot gets done, that there's this political gridlock up here. This was a showcase of that as opposed to any kind of remedy for it. And I think in letting it go to a vote, I think each side thought, oh, well, let the other side live with the consequences of their intransigence. And what they don't understand is that people just see intransigence. They don't assign necessarily a political affiliation to it.
Do you think that there's something, Susan, to what Russell was saying before, though, is the Republicans, they didn't make a shift, but they tried to hammer home the point that their decision to vote against Andrew McDonald had an awful lot to do with his performance on the bench, not having to do with his friendship with Governor Malloy or even his role as a state legislator beforehand.
Most definitely. And if you listen to some of the conversations on the Senate floor yesterday, Senator Fasano, Senator Kissel, they pointed directly to decisions that they had problems with, mainly the death penalty. And they felt that Andrew McDonald should have recused himself from some of those decisions because he not only was a legislator, but he was chief counsel to the governor, and he crafted that legislation. So he pushed that debate forward and then got people, they felt it was a bait and switch. He felt that they got the lawmakers to go along with that as long as it was prospective, that it wouldn't pertain to the people who were currently on death row, including the Cheshire two. And then when he got on the Supreme Court, that completely changed and the death penalty was abolished for all.
Joan Hartley, the one Democrat in the Senate that voted against the nomination, cited the death penalty when she was speaking on the floor. But to bring it back to how, you know, what the governor responded yesterday, you know, in the news conference, as he's talking about this vote, his communication staff is handing out pieces of paper that show certain pieces of legislation for civil unions to codify the Supreme Court decision for same-sex marriage and listing, you know, who voted against McDonald that also voted against those bills. So I think, you know, they're also very much trying to make this about his sexual orientation by going around and sort of proactively being, you know, here's a list of bills that these people voted on, you know, and here's how they voted on the Supreme Court justice nominee.
Could I just say that, I mean, look, as I say, a pox on all of their houses. They all screwed this up. But I do think the Republicans will bear a significant moral burden from this. They have politicized in a way that's unprecedented a Supreme Court nomination in Connecticut. They've made it, I mean, typically we don't do this. In other words, the reason there is a confirmation process is to weed out people who have severe character defects who are way, way outside the mainstream of jurisprudence. One thing you can say about Andrew McDonald, he's a pretty mainstream associate justice. He participated in a lot of majority decisions, you know, including the death penalty decision. He's not an outlier. He's not an ideological outlier with a lot of weird ideas. It's nothing like that. And I also would like to point out the degree to which this is focused on the past at a time when the public would like everybody to turn their attention to the present and future. The death penalty is not going to be an issue in the state of Connecticut ever again. It's gone. The necessity of debating it yesterday escapes me. I mean, it seems very much focused on the past. The last thing I'll say just two more things really quickly.
One thing
is the recusal issue is ridiculous. The idea that he should have recused himself. I interviewed Senator Fasano about this. I said, was there a motion from any party for him to recuse at that time? Nope. Did Chase Rogers, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, think he should recuse? Nope. Did you, as a political leader in Connecticut, or any other political leader in Connecticut from either party, suggest that McDonald, based on everything that you knew about him, and this is nothing new has come forward since then, did anybody like you suggest that he should recuse? No. So somehow or other, it's an indelible stain on the record of Andrew McDonald that it didn't occur to him to recuse himself when nobody, including people with big snarling dogs in the fight, ever suggested that he should recuse himself.
To be fair, Colin, he didn't really think it would matter.
That's right. Yeah. And lastly, I do want to just say one thing, because this is a bugaboo of mine. The Cheshire murders were really horrible. The notion that this whole notion that Susan brought up, the kind of prospective version of abolishing the death penalty, is predicated – I mean the prejudice towards only abolishing the death penalty in the future is based on some cockamamie idea that we will never have a horrible murder in Connecticut again, never as horrible as what happened to the Pettit family, that all of our murderers in the future will be nicer people than the two people who committed the Pettit murders. That's not true. First of all, there are other people on death row who are really horrible people too. And the other people who will commit terrible murders in the years and decades to come will be horrible people. There isn't a special moral status for Commissar Jeffsky and the other guy whose name I'm blocking. And so to suppose that is, I think, fantasy thinking.
Hayes, by the way.
Hayes, sorry about that.
Well, I think Colin raises a good point, and that is that there a lot was raised about the scrutiny of Andrew McDonald, including the governor and other Democrats, who said no other nominee has ever gone through this kind of process where they've challenged his decisions or asked about decisions. So that was definitely a factor here, and I think that many feel that he was treated unfairly, and no one has ever been held to this kind of a standard.
We got a tweet from CT Iron Man who asks, maybe we should go back to the process that yielded jurists like Chase Rogers, et cetera, promote someone who is a career jurist, not a career politician. I don't know, Russell, is this going to disqualify people who have political backgrounds from being nominated either to the bench or to this job of Chief Justice?
One gubernatorial candidate, Tim Herbst, has said he didn't agree with McDonald's appointment to the Supreme Court in the first place. And one argument he made was that you shouldn't go straight to the Supreme Court. You know, if you're going to be made a judge, you should start on a lower court. I don't know if that's something that, other people feel that way. But I think that was, certainly a consideration here was, but one interesting thing is his political background. That came up, the bill with the Catholic Church, that came up the first time around. And he was still approved overwhelmingly. So I think anybody that tried to make those arguments about his political views or the work he had done in the legislature and how that prevented him from having an open mind, we didn't see that in the first vote. So I think that those arguments kind of got thrown out the window when you saw an overwhelming vote in his favor the first time. The second time, though, I think it's about they focused on what he had done on the bench. Even as I said earlier, I think there were other reasons, but they sort of found a way to make a legal argument. A lot of it. Focusing on the death penalty, which, as Colin said, I don't think we're going to see raised again in Connecticut. But getting back to Tim Herbst, he has said he would introduce legislation to reinstate the death penalty. So, it's out there, at least from one person.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Just very quickly, there might be an argument similar to the one that CT Iron Man is making. However, Earl Warren, for example, made it to the U.S. Supreme Court as its Chief Justice with no previous experience as a judge. And that routinely happens on the Supreme Court. Elena Kagan, I believe, has no Supreme Court justice, no judicial experience prior to becoming a Supreme Court justice. And, you can look at it another way, which is that Andrew McDonald at this moment has five more years on the Supreme Court than Chase Rogers had when she became Chief Justice. In other words, she had no time as an Associate Justice before becoming Chief Justice. So I don't know. I think it's hard to make rules for everybody. They don't work for everybody.
I just want to ask one last question, Colin. Yeah, Kimberly from East Haven called. She just had a question that I'll ask. She says, Andrew McDonald was asked directly about his wedding during a public hearing in Judiciary Committee. In what context was any other nominee in the history of Connecticut ever asked that question?
True. On the other hand, I think he was asked to comment about his wedding. I mean, when people bring that up, I first of all, I don't blame people who are upset about the LGBTQ part of this, but it's a little sneaky to bring it up that way. He was asked, I believe, about the fact that his wedding took place at the governor's mansion and was performed by the governor. He wasn't asked, like, hey, you had a gay wedding, didn't you? The question, I think, had to do with his relationship with Malloy and the fact that his relationship with Malloy was sufficiently personal that Malloy took it upon himself or was at least persuaded to perform the wedding.
The point, I guess, being, Susan, that your wedding becomes something that the public is able to talk about if indeed you're really good friends with the governor and you have it at the governor's mansion.
I think it's really good friends with the governor is the issue here. I don't think it really weighs in whether he officiated, the governor officiated their wedding or not, and how many other candidates or people who are being nominated are asked who officiated at their wedding.
Susan Raff is a political reporter for WFSB Channel 3. Russell Blair is here. He's from the Hartford Courant. Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. They're all doing a very good job. I'm having a hard time saying words this morning for some reason. I'll do much better in the next segment. You can call us at 860-275-7266. We're going to turn to the governor's race and find out if there's anything new this week at all the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse or give us a call 860-275-7266. Joined today by Russell Blair. He's a reporter for the Hartford Courant. Susan Raff is a reporter. She reports on politics for Channel 3. And Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, what's on your show today?
I'm so happy that today, when you ask me this question, it's not like yodeling or something like it usually is, but it's actually something that maybe even connects to the conversation we just had. So because of the incarceration policies in the 1980s and early 1990s, a lot of people wound up in prison. And now there's this kind of gray-haired tsunami of people who have been in prison a long time. They're getting older. People's health problems, unsurprisingly, are worse in prison than when they're not in prison. That people in that situation are very expensive to house, and most of them are kind of, you know, don't represent a major threat to their communities. So compassionate release would seem to be a really good solution to a whole range of problems occasioned by this. But it doesn't get used very often. It is an underused tool to deal with a pretty obvious problem. We're going to talk about why that is.
That's a fascinating conversation. That's today, 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. So the field of candidates seeking to be Connecticut's next governor doesn't appear to be getting any smaller, even though the state party conventions are a little bit more than a month away. This week, however, one prominent Democrat, State Attorney General George Jepson, made an attempt to narrow the race for his party's nomination, publicly throwing his support to Ned Lamont.
Over the course of the campaign, his integrity and his ability will shine through, and people will appreciate the fact that he is prepared to make the hard choices that need to be made in Connecticut.
So that's George Jepson. He's, of course, not running to be attorney general, and he is sticking his neck out and saying Ned Lamont should be the next governor of Connecticut. I just want to say briefly, Colin, I thought that was actually a fairly enthusiastic sounding George Jepson. He's usually fairly muted.
He had the 4 Red Bulls before he before he said that.
Okay, so what do we make of this? George Jepson saying Ned Lamont is his candidate.
It doesn't mean much, but it means something. All right, so and what it means, I think, if it means anything, is that as we head towards the convention, you can make the argument. I always get a little lightheaded when I say this because I can't believe it's true.
It's the Red Bulls.
But I think it is. I think it is true that it's starting to look like maybe this could be a 2-way race between Lamont and Bicewicz. You know, I don't know.
We're just going to pause and let that sit for a while.
I know. That's why I say it. I get lightheaded when I say that. But it looks like that could be the case. I mean, you know, Bronin is still a little bit of a wild card. Maybe you could say Harris still has some footing. But really, it's starting to look like it might be one of these two. Now, first of all, the one thing that we can all remember is that George Jepson in some ways owes his current status in life to the fact that Susan Bicewicz ran for attorney general without apparently being fully qualified and that he was one of the people who called attention to this fact. So it's unsurprising that he might be backing. I mean, I'm sure there's still kind of a Taylor Swift, Katy Perry thing going on there. It's unsurprising that he would be backing the other person, the person who is not Susan Bicewicz. I think if it means anything, as you head to the convention, it means, I mean, no, there's no no block anymore. There's not a Malloy block. God knows there's not a Jepson block. There isn't a block of convention delegates of any size that anybody can deliver. They're mostly geographic kind of blocks, like maybe, you know, Tony Harp can deliver New Haven to somebody or something like that. So, but it does mean that sort of some conventional Democrats who maybe, you know George pretty well, listen to him and stuff, it might mean something to them. It might make it easier for Lamont to sew up more delegates and maybe make it harder for one of the other people to qualify out of the convention. But other than that, I would say no.
I just want to quickly make sure people who are listening not that terribly closely understand that neither Katy Perry nor Taylor Swift have entered the race for Connecticut governor.
Yet.
Susan?
I think it's interesting also. I mean, we've seen a lot of Ned Lamont. He is at the Capitol, the legislative office building, quite a lot these days. Susan Bisewitz, we've not really seen her. She's not officially explored. But I agree. I think that the more talk at the Capitol these days, as far as Democrats are concerned, that those are going to be the contenders. Is the Jepson, nod a good thing? Yeah, possibly. I mean, a lot of these candidates are going to get that over the course of the weeks and months. But Ned Lamont is certainly making an effort to adhere himself to a lot of Democrats at the state capitol.
Our friend Max Reese, Russell, tweeted about this, his analysis. Here's why Jepson's announcement is a big deal. He doesn't do many major press events. He spends his political capital sparingly as the most popular constitutional office holder in the state. So there's something to that.
Yeah, I mean, and this maybe shakes loose some other endorsements from some other people. I mean, if there's some people that, you know, have sort of been quietly backing Bisewitz, maybe this prompts them to come out more publicly, you know, but in the grand scheme of things, I don't know how important this is. One thing that I think is, you know, as Colin was saying, you know, there isn't really a group of people that you can identify as supporting one candidate or the other. And we're very, very close to the convention. So it seems like there's, you know, bits and pieces in different cities and towns that are backing different people. I get a million emails every Monday usually of, you know, endorsements. The Torrington vice chairman of the town council is endorsing this person, and the New London mayor is endorsing this person. So it seems like there's a lot of people spread out, throughout there. And I think part of it is because there's, you know, so many candidates in the race.
If each email into my inbox was a stand-in for a vote, I'm pretty sure Jonathan Harris would have already been governor of the state of Connecticut. Quickly, Susan?
I think Bisewitz and Lamont have some juice in the sense that they're Democrats and they're not closely aligned with Malloy. And I think that will propel them.
Not closely aligned with Malloy. Just thinking back to the history of Ned Lamont as a political force in Connecticut, back to his run against Joe Lieberman, he's been sort of playing back and forth, Colin, with the party, how he stands in the party, who in the Democratic Party establishment is going to get behind Ned Lamont, either as a gubernatorial candidate or as a candidate for Senate. I guess I just wonder if he's being seen as someone because he's been here for some time, because he's put in some serious time. I'm trying to raise, questions about the issues in Connecticut over the years, and he keeps coming back for more. If maybe he is gaining support from some of the traditional Democrats in the state who didn't necessarily support him before.
Yeah. Long haul, I don't think that matters. Long haul, I think we know he's going to qualify at the convention. I think we know Bisewitz is going to qualify at the convention. We think maybe Bronin could. I'm not sure. But then the registered Democrats who vote in the primary in August, they are the ones who are going to decide this. And for the most part, they are not heavily influenced by George Jepson or anybody else. You know, they're going to make their own decision based on what kind of case these two candidates make for themselves. They're both going to run against Dan Malloy. Susan is going to say, I'm not this Susan. Susan Bisewitz is going to say, I don't know, I haven't been around here for 10 years. You can't blame me for this stuff. I don't even know where the office is where you go file your paperwork. I got no idea, you know. And Ned is going to say basically the same thing. Don't blame me. You know, I even sort of semi kind of almost ran against this guy one time. You know, don't blame me. I had nothing to do with this. So they're both going to do that. And I mean, ultimately, you have to have some actual policies besides I'm not Dan Malloy and I don't know him that well. And we'll see what those are and what kind of case they can make.
But it's a start. Let's move on. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, Mark Boughton is hoping to clear up lingering concerns about his health. He'll hold a press conference today, we understand, where his doctors are expected to take questions from the media. Russell, we tackled this a bit last week. Certainly, some of the snafus about the way the candidates' camp has handled his health concerns. I mean, what's new here, and how are they trying to mitigate some of the damage that's been caused?
Well, Mark Boughton's going to have two doctors at a news conference. He's going to have the doctor from University of Pittsburgh that did the brain surgery last year to remove the lemon-sized tumor. And then he has his primary care doctor from Danbury. Who's not going to be there, though, is the doctor that treated him at UConn Health Center in Farmington, where he was sent after he collapsed in Avon. So I think, you know, that's going to be a question people are going to have is what, you know, why aren't we hearing from the doctor who treated you on that day? And something that we talked about before the show started is, you know, does this sort of continue the story of what happened with Mark Boughton? You know, there was a lot of coverage of it. It kind of died down, and now he's having a news conference, and this is going to kind of continue the story.
Well, I think anytime, you know, when you're running, you have to be very careful in your campaign. And I agree. I think it was handled poorly when he collapsed. And then the next day should have probably come out and addressed it to everybody. And that would have maybe put it to rest. I agree that, you know, I'm not so sure what will come out of this other than people may who have not even known what was going on the first time are going, oh, well, what's going on now? But in the same sense, too, I guess if you're going to run for governor, voters want to be assured that you're okay and you're physically okay. So I have a mixed feeling about what they're doing today, but that's their campaign and that's what they're doing.
You say you have a mixed feeling. Give me a little bit more on your mixed feeling. Well,
first of all, she has to go cover it. Yeah. That's the first problem. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's for him as a candidate bringing more attention to that factor. And then this article that's been surfaced, I don't know, we've talked about it, an old article, an old person who worked in their campaign, who worked in that office is claiming that Mark Boughton and Senator McLaughlin, who voted yesterday, are homophobes because they asked this Danbury City employee why didn't he tell them he was gay. So that's now coming out again, and I don't know, whatever.
I think it might leave us with, you know, maybe more questions than answers, and it continues the news cycle. And also, you know, I think if we recall during the presidential election, you know, Trump's doctor released a report saying how healthy he was.
And, There's never been anybody healthier in the world than Donald Trump.
So, you know, you do have to take this with a grain of salt. I think transparency is great, but I also think that you know, we don't know exactly what we're going to get today, and is it going to answer all the questions that people have? And as Susan pointed out, you know, it may backfire and continue to raise new questions or make this into more of an issue than it was at the first place.
Right. So, you know, there's nothing I enjoy less than these kinds of conversations. And I think we have two American societal values in conflict. The first one is that health matters should be private, right? I mean, that's like something we all believe. There's laws that exist to ensure that health matters should be private. But when you're running for office, as Hillary Clinton can tell you, don't fall over. It's just if you fall over, you're going to have to answer a whole bunch of questions about your health. I like Mark Boughton. I think he has a rocky road ahead of him. Even if you took this health thing out of the equation for some of the stuff that Susan was just alluding to. And I mean, any campaign is going to have a lot of bumps and bruises. But now he's got a problem, and it's murky enough so that if he can't put it to rest, he's going to drag it around for the rest of the campaign. That's what he's trying to do today. He's trying to make the health version of the Obama Jeremiah Walker speech. You know, he's trying to just do an event that just puts this thing to bed, and maybe it will. Maybe he will be able to do that successfully. I will say that. You know, I mean, he hasn't helped himself in a lot of his explanations. I mean, I think they really did try to underplay the significance of it when it happened at the time. And then there's this whole idea that he's on the campaign trail and he eats too much junk food, which makes him the second person to use the Twinkie defense. I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I look at him and he's a person who I personally like but ideologically disagree with. And I find myself thinking, if you really are having health problems, go home. This isn't worth it. You know, it really isn't worth it. And the other thing about, I just will quickly say, I said this in my column last week, and you've been alluding to it too. Nobody ever drops out of this campaign. It's really like The Bachelorette if every week they never got rid of anybody. You know, in fact, if they occasionally added people. I mean, other than Dan Drew, has anybody gotten out of this race? And Aaron Stewart's gotten into the race recently. I mean, you need to get rid of some people here.
I think that's the interesting point. Health aside, I think Mark Boughton, and I think that New Britain Mayor Aaron Stewart injects herself at a really key time. I think a lot of people think that they may even partner up.
Given the context, you should probably reword that. She doesn't actually inject herself.
But I do. I think that she adds something to this race that perhaps has been lacking. And it's one of the reasons why Senator Tony Boucher has been allowed to be in some of these debates. She's not officially declared her candidacy. She has not raised the money, that the threshold that she needs to. So I think that they want a woman in this race. I think the Republicans want that. And if Aaron Stewart can finagle something into this, I think that she would be very palatable.
Boucher made a real power move. She showed up at the Winstead Community Bookstore to talk to the folks on Main Street there just the last week. That's when you know things are getting serious. Let's take a break. When we come back, we want to talk about two mayors of big cities who are both asking for help from the state. They're also both running for governor. One is being a little bit more successful than the other as far as getting state aid. We'll talk about that with Susan Raff from Channel 3, with Russell Blair from the Hartford Current, and Colin McEnroe from WNPR here on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe from Connecticut Public Radio, Susan Raff from Channel 3, WFSB, and Russell Blair from the Hartford Current. I want to turn to Luke Bronin and Joe Ganim, Democratic mayors of two of the largest cities in the states. Both would like to be the state's next governor. Both are on the lookout for more financial aid for their cities. The state, however, is bailing out Bronin's Hartford. Ganim's Bridgeport, not terribly happy about it. I just saw a city official from New Haven yesterday who's really not happy about this in New Haven. I don't know. I'll start with you, Colin, as we have Luke Bronin, another friend of the governor who worked closely with the governor, leading Hartford, also leading himself into the governor's race right now. Looks like he's getting about $550 million paid off for his struggling city, while some of the other cities are still asking for more.
Yeah, I guess you have to sort of pull these two things apart, right? One of them is, one part of it is policy, and the other part is how it might affect his candidacy. You know, as policy, I think it's good policy in a bad situation. You have a city that's teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. They made the traditional trade-off, state oversight for money. You know, here's some money, but here's your allowance, but, you know, you get some new curfews and you get some and I mean, that's probably a good move, and I don't think it's good for Connecticut as a whole to have its capital city teetering on the brink or entering into bankruptcy, although there are some good things that can come out of bankruptcy as well. We could talk about those. But so basically probably a good move. Stabilize your capital city. Don't have it wheeled into the ICU right around this time. In terms of Bronin's candidacy, I mean, I've always thought, and I like Luke Bronin too. I keep saying I like people, but I like Luke Bronin as a person. I've enjoyed him in many ways as a mayor, but he really did say he was going to stay the course as a mayor. Now he's not, and he thinks that he can run on the record of the city. And I just don't see how you can say, wow, when my city was a real mess, when it was almost bankrupt, I got some money from the state, and I let the state take over oversight of a lot of governmental functions, which ordinarily as mayor I would be in charge of. I don't see how that's something you run on. Maybe that I'm missing a point here.
No, I think it's a black eye. I mean, but in addition to the money, which we knew was coming, there's an oversight board, and I think what they're trying to do is set up what they did in Waterbury several years ago. Whether that's successful or not, I think that Hartford's problems are really systemic in the sense that you can't just fix it with money. They have to change the whole tax structure. I mean, I think 50% of the properties in Hartford are tax exempt. So, and I agree. I think that if you're going to run, he hasn't really solved any of the problems in Hartford. He didn't necessarily create them, but he hasn't solved them.
Reading from our colleague at WSHU's report on this, the New Haven Mayor Tony Harp and Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim have said in a joint statement, the state's shortchanging their cities while, quote, rewarding the past practices of other cities that put them on the edge of financial collapse. They say, quote, Connecticut requires comparable support for its two most populous urban centers. So I don't know, Russell. Colin makes a case that the capital city shouldn't be teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, and then maybe the state needs to do something about it. But we've got other cities who are saying, look, we're not in the same mess as Hartford right now because we've run ourselves better, but we still have some of the same problems.
One of those two mayors, Joe Ganim, I was doing an interview with him, and kind of unprompted, we were talking about the casino legislation. You know, Bridgeport wants the state to reopen the process so MGM can put in a bid for a casino in Bridgeport. And we were talking about that, and then he just sort of veered off and started talking about the Hartford bailout and the money that was going to the city of Hartford and how, you know, Luke Bronin was benefiting from that. And I think that this is going to become a campaign issue, you know, circling back to, again, the governor's race. You know, I think this is something that we saw, you know, Joe Ganim, another candidate, jump on this. We saw pretty much any Republican in the race, you know, jumping in on this and saying, you know, why is Hartford getting this money? But it's interesting because, you know, it's sort of, you know, New Haven and Bridgeport are trying to make the argument that, you know, we did things correctly and now, you know, we're being punished and we're coming to the state and asking, you know, we have a private developer who's expressed interest in doing something that won't cost the state any money and you're not helping us. But then when Hartford wants state money, you know, you're helping them. But I agree with Colin, you know, regardless of your party affiliation, I think having the capital city go bankrupt is not in the best interest of anybody in the state.
Yeah, but having any of the big cities go bankrupt over time, Colin, isn't good for the state. New Haven is maybe a little special case because of the presence of Yale University and what it enables as a tax-exempt organization that city to do. Bridgeport, however, is a big city, a city that has – this is not the first time it's courted casino gambling as a possible panacea. I don't know. I mean, how should we view Bridgeport from up here – up here in Hartford as far as our need to make sure that Bridgeport is a going concern moving forward?
In a shining era of American urbanism, which I think we're kind of in, Connecticut does not have vibrant cities unless you count Stamford, which I don't count. And
Governor Malloy is on line one.
Well, no, Stamford benefits from its umbilical relationship to New York City in a way that no other city can. To me, ultimately, the next governor is going to have to address not one city's problems, but all cities' problems. I don't think there's any easy fix for that, but it's a long conversation that we're going to have. And making it specific to Bridgeport or Hartford or anywhere else, I mean, I know it's like Lear's daughters now, but I think that that's the wrong way to look at it. I know it's the way that mayors always look at it. I would say one – I mean, it pains me to say it because it will please him if it gets back to him. But, you know, New Haven benefits not only from Yale but from the long Mubarak-like tenure of John DeStefano, who was a really good mayor in a lot of ways and figured out a lot of things. He made that comparison one time, not me. But
I didn't know he did that. It's very funny.
I said when he was leaving.
He's a funny guy, isn't
he? I asked him about leaving, and he said, well, at least it wasn't like Mubarak didn't drag me out of my bed in the middle of the night. But no, I mean, you know, mayors also are supposed to fix their cities rather than complain incessantly to the state. So it's a little bit of a two-way street. The one thing I just want to add here, and I'm doing this on cat's paws because I know it could land wrong, is that I think Aaron Stewart has a little bit of this problem too. People who live in New Britain who are listening right now, I like your city a lot, and I like it enough to visit on a regular basis. My son and I often go in. We go to Urban Oaks. We eat a great taste. And, you know, there's like some great things about New Britain. When I'm driving around New Britain to go to these places, what I don't think is, wow, whoever runs this place ought to have a lot more responsibilities here in Connecticut. I mean, New Britain's got a lot of problems. And I do think that ultimately for Stewart, if she runs statewide – the commercial that's going to be made about her is somebody just like taking a camera up Oak Street or something. And, you know, this is the city she runs.
Well, and also that city has been the beneficiary of a controversial investment by the state, one that many Republicans have railed against for years. But this busway, Susan, has prompted development up and down it, not necessarily all in New Britain, but it can't hurt. So she's benefiting from a lot of, you know, Democratic policies over the years.
Yeah, and you've seen some of that. There's a little bit of new development, or I shouldn't say new, should say new restaurants, and a little bit near the fast track, if you will.
Still call it the busway. Sorry.
The busway, the fast track. So she's benefited from that. But I agree. I don't think I've seen that much. There isn't as far as bringing the city together in a cleaner way, although she has cleaned up downtown a little bit. To try to bring a new life into the city. But it's not exactly a pillar of, wow, this is really a successful city.
And that's something that could hurt her in a Republican primary. I mean, there's been news conferences where she's been alongside Dan Malloy talking about how great this is. You know, we know how there are a lot of people that hate the busway. If you put the word busway on a mailer, it does great with some constituencies. So You know, that's certainly something that, you know, those photos of her and Malloy and her accepting state money for this, you know, could be something that people come back
to. She is, of course, also running as someone who can stand next to the governor, who can stand next to Democrats and have a normal type of relationship. She's not running as a kind of a red meat Republican that you might see in the Trump era.
And I think, you know, I was at the news conference where she announced and talking to people afterwards, and former state party chair Jerry Labriola is working for her campaign. And, you know, he said that, you know, she neutralizes a lot of the lines of attack that you would see against most of the other Republicans running in the race, you know, that they're bigoted or that they can't work with Democrats or that their views are so extreme. And she sort of disarms a lot of those viewpoints. So I think that, you know, if she gets into a primary, you know, if she goes as far as a general, I think it would be a very interesting campaign because it might change the strategy that Democrats are using right now and maybe that they plan to use going forward.
I wanted to just turn quickly because we're almost out of time here. Susan, I know that you were covering the events on this past Saturday, marches in Hartford, different cities across Connecticut, marches for gun control across America, including huge turnouts in places like New York City and Washington, D.C. We've seen this before, and we saw it recently with the school walkout in the middle of the week. Was there anything different about what you saw on Saturday?
I think there is something different, and it started with Parkland and the shooting there. And in fact, we were fortunate enough, we hooked up with some people there. They were actually staying at the hotel we were. And it's still very raw to them. They had a hard time talking about it. But when you see the energy of these young people who have been in lockdowns their whole lives, decide that this is the time for change, and they're going to vote, and they want to vote. And in fact, at the march, there were dozens of people who were registering people to vote. So I do think that there's a different dynamic here.
Mm. Colin, do you see something different out of this past weekend's marches than we've seen in the gun debate previously?
Yes and no. I think that, you know, people, there's a theorist, I think her name is Talia Shiro, who's doing a lot of studying recently about sort of how people make political decisions. Unsurprisingly, they're driven by our amygdalas and our hippocampi as opposed to our more rational thinking apparatus of our brains. And so when you get people very emotional about something like this, you can motivate them. You can motivate them to march. You can motivate them to register to vote. Gun law change in this country is very, very hard to accomplish. You can change small things and get results, smallish results, and it's worth doing. It's worth trying. Probably the thing that would really fix us is a real reduction in the number of guns. 300 million guns is just too many. But we're not going to have an Australian-style enforced buyback program here because of the Second Amendment.
I think until this becomes an issue where you see Republicans losing elections over this, where there's exit poll data that shows, you know, someone voted this way strictly because of, you know, a candidate's views on guns, I think that's what it's going to come to. And that's something that, you know, I've talked to Senator Murphy about this issue a lot. And that's what he said, is that, you know, this needs to be a ballot box issue. These gun violence prevention activists need to be as rabid as the Second Amendment people. They need to rally their base. They need to get people out. They need to register them to vote. And they have to make this a campaign issue. Because I think if you're a Republican, until, you know, you look at the data and say, gee, I might lose my seat if I, you know, don't come to the table on this, I think that's going to be the ultimate deciding factor. And I think the marches over the weekend might push more towards that.
I'd like to see if more companies like Delta and others who have taken a strong stand and could lose tax dollars, how many more? Or is that just an effort to placate people and say, you know, we're a good company, we're for you? I think it's true that a lot has been done maybe in the past few weeks as far as energy, but where it goes from there, as Colin said, the gun lobbyists and the gun manufacturers, that's here.
There was actually a really interesting story on NPR the other day, and it's been picked up on by a lot of other media, Colin. You know, as we see Remington going bankrupt, one of the reasons behind it, not perhaps, but for real, is that people aren't buying guns right now in the same numbers, in part perhaps because of some of the shootings that have happened, but also in part because we have a Republican in the White House and Republicans in control of the legislature, and we see this over and over again. When Republicans are in control, people don't buy as many guns, and that's bad for gun manufacturers. We just have 30 seconds left, but I don't know what that tells us about America right now.
Yeah, there's something darkly hilarious about the fact that Remington ramped up production because they were almost certain that Hillary Clinton would win, and therefore they would be doing land office business with their guns. And so that was a very, very bad business decision that they're paying for right now. I don't to, you know, tease out the morality of that would take probably a few hours.
Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Susan Raff from Channel 3, Russell Blair from the Hartford Current. Thanks so much to Scott Breedy, who produces The Wheelhouse. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Kion Wolf is our technical producer. Thanks to everyone who listens to The Wheelhouse here on WNPR.